we are delighted that Brian Stevenson has come. We thank Atlantic for making it happen. For without their support, we couldn't have hoped to put on an event such as this. And he, Brian, is one of the foremost public interest lawyers in the United States at the present time. He is an inspiration to lawyers not only in the United States now, but through his international recognition through TEDx and YouTube and the many zillion of hits that you will see for his speeches there. He is now a world leading figure in the area of public interest law, and we are absolutely delighted and honoured that he has found the time to join us here this evening. He was born in a poor rural community in the southern United States, and ultimately graduated from Harvard, but far from thoughts of making it on Wall Street, he returned to the southern United States and established the Equal Justice Initiative, which is now at the cutting edge of legal pioneering work in tackling racial injustice and poverty and inequality across a whole range of areas of work and across a whole diverse range of types of litigation about which we will hear this evening. And he has exhibited in that an unstinting commitment to greater equality in the United States. He has achieved along the way endless awards and plaudits. He's just come off a book tour for his best-selling book, Just Mercy, which will be launched on this side of the Atlantic shortly after Christmas. And so I would like, in the memory of Dave Ellis and in taking this opportunity to welcome Dave's family, as I see Sarah and Brian and other members of Dave Ellis's family here this evening, and as every year we're delighted to have them join us in this event, which does recollect the pioneering community legal activism of Dave Ellis, which he conducted for many decades, and which we commemorate here this evening. And in his honour, it is my great pleasure to welcome Brian Stevenson.
Thank you so much. I'm really honored to be here tonight. I'm delighted to participate in this lecture series. I didn't have the privilege of knowing Dave Ellis, but I had the great opportunity to spend some time in the FLAC office this afternoon learning more about the extraordinary work that he did, and also the extraordinary work of this organization. I am most impressed with everyone I've had the chance to meet at FLAC and the incredible work that they are doing to facilitate greater justice in this country. I am persuaded that justice isn't some static thing. You have to keep pushing for it, you have to fight for it, you have to protect it. And when you're indifferent, when you're not moving, when you're not struggling to protect justice, there will be injustice. And even in great societies like this, there are going to be challenges and needs. And to learn about an organization of people who are trying to meet those needs is, for me, very, very encouraging. Very, very affirming. I also love this model of bringing in people who are required to get close to the needs of the poor, required to hear about the challenges of people who have been, in many ways, victimized by our excess and greed, who can't meet mortgage payments, who can't protect themselves from jail and confinement because of their poverty, who are dealing with a range of the challenges that we see all over the globe. And so it's been great encouragement to me to hear and learn about the work of FLAC and to have this opportunity to be with you in Ireland. I love Ireland. This is my third trip here. I think it's an incredible country. We have so many Irish Americans in the United States that I've had the privilege of working with, but there's nothing quite like being in this space and getting a feel for the character and quality of this country. And I really wanted to talk tonight about four things that I am persuaded that we all need to think more critically about if we're really going to advance social justice. There are always going to be forces that will push a society, that will push our globe toward inequality,
toward disparate outcomes and disparate opportunities. And I think there has always got to be a community of people who are organizing themselves to fight against that, to protect those who are going to be disfavored or views. And I want to talk about these four dynamics. And my reflections on this really have come from my work in the States. In the States, we've had a really difficult era, particularly relating to our criminal justice system. We had 300,000 people in jails and prisons in 1972. Today, we have 2.3 million people in jails and prisons. The United States has the highest rate of incarceration in the world. We possess 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's imprisoned. And the challenging thing about it is that we're not really ashamed of that. We have some 6 million people on probation and parole. We have some 68 million people in the States who have criminal arrests, and they may have to report that when they apply for a job. There is this despair, this shadow, that has fallen over many communities in America that is a result of over-incarceration and excessive punishment. The Bureau of Justice reports that 1 in 3 black male babies in the United States is expected to go to jail or prison during his lifetime. That was not true in the 20th century, that was not true in the 19th century, it didn't become true until the 21st century. We've had a 640% increase in the number of women being sent to prison, 70% of whom have minor children who get placed in foster care and have really bad outcomes as a result of an incarcerated mom. We put people in jails and prisons for writing bad checks and simple possession of marijuana. And there is this great concern that we created a society that can be really indifferent to cruel and abusive treatment. And for me, challenging that has meant reflecting on what are the dynamics of confronting injustice anywhere, Ireland, America, any place in the globe. And I want to start by talking about that. I think the first dynamic is proximity. I am persuaded that in every society, there have to be people who are willing to get close to the people who are suffering, get close to the places where there is exclusion and bias and discrimination, have to get close to the poor and the disfavored. And I say that because only in proximity that we can we really understand what the nature of the problem is. We oftentimes try to make policies and decisions about how to deal with big issues, but we try to make them from a distance. And when we try to make decisions from a distance, we get it wrong. We don't hear things that we can hear when we're proximate. We don't see things that we can see when we're proximate. I'm persuaded that proximity is essential to creating justice, which is why I think it's so important that lawyers come in and listen to the concerns of the poor and those who are having problems accessing justice. That listening, that proximity is, I think, essential to creating justice. I learned about this not from my work. I learned about this growing up in a community where we were isolated. As a poor minority community, we were isolated. We lived in the margins. We had segregation and racial exclusion. I started my education in the colored school. In my community, black children weren't allowed into the public school. There was no high school for black kids, and my father couldn't go to high school because there was no black high school. And I remember when lawyers came into our community, I became proximate, and made them open up the public school system so that I could go there and other kids like me. We had a decision banning racial segregation in schools, but it wasn't implemented for a decade. And those lawyers came in and made it possible for me to go to the public high school. And because of their intervention, I'm standing here talking to you today. Without their intervention, I wouldn't be. And that proximity allowed me to then go to college. And I had a great college experience. I went to a beautiful small college in Pennsylvania, and I was a philosophy major. And I loved my college experience. I could play sports and do music, and I just was having the time of my life. I would get on the hillside and think all of these great deep thoughts, and I was reading Hegel and Kant and these great pieces of literature, Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, and I just was having the time of my life. And then during my senior year one day, someone walked up to me and said, "Well, what are you going to do after you graduate from college?" And I interpreted this as sort of a hostile question because I'd never really thought about that. And it dawned on me that nobody was going to pay me to philosophize. And so I frantically started scrambling to figure out how I could extend my education. I looked into graduate programs in political science and history and psychology. And much to my shock, in the States, to do graduate work in these areas, you actually have to know something about the area. So that was pretty intimidating to me. So I kept my search going, and that's how I found law school. Because in America, you don't have to know anything to go to law school. And so I showed up at Harvard Law School waiting for them to do something for me. And I'll be honest, 3 months into my law school career, I thought I'd made the wrong decision. I was going to law school because I wanted to do something about poverty and race and justice. And they weren't talking about race. They weren't talking about poverty. They weren't talking about justice. They were talking about torts and civil procedure and contracts. And I found it very alienating. And during my first year, I resolved that I wasn't going to stay at the law school. I decided to go to the School of Government. And perhaps there I'd find some pathway to kind of give space to these passions that I have. And I went to the Harvard School of Government the next year. And 3 months into that program, I realized that I hated it even more than the law school. They were teaching us to maximize benefits and minimize costs, but it didn't seem to matter whose costs got minimized and whose benefits got maximized. And it was apolitical in a way that I couldn't make sense of, so I kind of reluctantly went back to the law school and was trying to reconcile myself to a career that I knew would not be fully engaging. And then I had the opportunity to work with an organization during my second year that provided legal services to death row prisoners. And I eagerly signed up to spend a month with this organization, and I went to Georgia to spend time, and there I found a community of lawyers, like the community of people I met today at FLAC, who were deeply engaged, whose lives were animated by the problems that they were trying to solve, who were committed and were preoccupied with justice. They talked about poverty all the time, they talked about race all the time, and finally I found a community that I thought I could connect to. And I'd been there about a week when the director asked me to go to death row and meet one of the condemned men that they hadn't had time to meet. And they said, we want you to go down there and just explain to this man that he's not at risk of execution anytime in the next year. And I was very excited about the opportunity, but I was kind of nervous. I came to the office the next day and said, I'm ready to go to death row. Which lawyer is coming with me? They said, well, we can't spare a lawyer. You've got to go by yourself. And all of a sudden, I was quite overwhelmed with this responsibility. I got in my car. I started driving down to Georgia's death row, and I was so nervous. I kept preparing myself for this encounter. I started rehearsing what I was going to say to this man. And I got to the prison, I walked inside, and was quickly intimidated by its facade. And there were these doors clanging and bars everywhere. And they took me back to this very small visitation room, and I was waiting there. And the longer I waited, the more anxious I became. And finally, they opened the door, and there stood on the other side of this door this condemned man, completely covered in chains. They had chains around his ankles. They had a chain around his waist. They had chains on his hands, these handcuffs. And it took them 10 minutes to get the chains off of him so he could come into the room. And while I watched them remove these chains, I just became so anxious that when he walked over, finally unchained, I walked up to him, and I forgot everything I'd been rehearsing, and I just started apologizing. I said, I'm so sorry. I'm just a law student. I'm so sorry I don't know much about the death penalty. I'm sorry I don't know much about legal process. I'm sorry I don't know much about the appeals process. I'm sorry I don't know much about criminal procedure. I'm sorry I don't know much about the litigation stages. But they sent me down here to tell you that you're not at risk of execution anytime in the next year. And when I said that, I never will forget the man stopping me. He said, wait, 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 say that again. I said, they sent me down here to tell you that you're not at risk of execution anytime in the next year. And then he grabbed my hands and he said, wait, say that again. And I said, you're not at risk of execution anytime in the next year. And at that point, this man hugged me and he said, I can't tell you how grateful I am for that. He said, you're the first person I've actually met who's not a death row prisoner or death row guard in the 2 years I've been on death row. He said, I can't tell you what this means to me. He said, I haven't let my wife or my children come and visit me because I was afraid they'd show up and I'd have an execution date. Now that I have this information, I'm going to see my wife, I'm going to see my children. And in my ignorance, I realized that being proximate, even in this simple way, I'd had an impact on the quality of this man's life. We sat down and we started having this conversation. It turned out that he had exactly my birthday, same month, same day, same year. And we fell into conversation. He was asking me questions about myself, and I was asking him questions about him, and before I knew it, 15 minutes turned into an hour, and an hour turned into 2 hours, and 2 hours turned into 3 hours. And even though I'd only scheduled to be there for an hour, we were still talking 3 hours later, and the guards came into the room because they were angry that I'd gone way past my time, and they couldn't really do anything to me, but they started treating this man very roughly. They put him against the wall, and they put the handcuffs on his wrist very tight. They then wrapped the chain around his waist, and I could see him grimacing. I tried to stop them from being so rough, but they weren't paying me any attention. And then they wrapped the chains around his ankles. They put the shackles on his ankles, and they were pushing him very roughly. And I tried to get them to stop, but they were paying me no mind. But the man kept saying to me, he said, Brian, don't worry about this. Just come back. And I watched him pushing this man very aggressively, very roughly toward the door. And he looked at me again and said, Brian, don't worry about this. I've just come back. And just before they were about to push him through the door, I watched there and I saw him do something completely unforgettable. They were trying to push him out of the room, and I watched him plant his feet on the floor. And this last time when they pushed him, he didn't move. And he looked at me and he said one last time, he said, Brian, don't worry about this. I just come back. And then he did something I've never forgotten. I stood there and I watched this man, covered with these chains, close his eyes, throw his head back, and then start to sing. It completely stunned me. He started singing this hymn I hadn't heard since I was a little boy in church. He started singing, I'm pressing on the upward way. New heights I'm gaining every day, still praying as I'm onward bound. And then he said, Lord, plant my feet on higher ground. Everybody stopped. And then the guard started pushing him toward the door, and you could hear these chains clanging down the hallway as this man was being pushed down the hallway, but you could also hear him singing about higher ground. I don't know what I expected, but I certainly didn't expect a condemned prisoner to sing to me about getting to higher ground. And in that moment, in that proximity, I found something deeply meaningful to me about the humanity of incarcerated and condemned people that I'd read about, I thought about, I talked about, but hadn't experienced. And having experienced it changed my relationship to law and to lawyering. All of a sudden, there was nothing I wanted to do more than to help condemned people get to higher ground. I felt like he'd given me this gift, and when I got back to law school, you couldn't keep me out of the law library. I needed to understand everything about criminal law and constitutional law, comparative law, procedure. All of it meant something different because I'd been proximate to a condemned prisoner. Proximity is essential. It means that when everybody else is getting as far away from the poorest sections or the biggest problems, some of us actually have to get closer. When everybody else is running from new people in the country, immigrants, and those that are coming from different cultures and places, trying to create space and distance from them, some of us have to get close. When others in our society are trying to stay as far away from the travelers and the Roma and those who are coming to our shores in a different space, some of us have to get closer and evaluate critically and thoughtfully how we create greater justice. I'm persuaded that proximity is essential to the work of FLAC. It's essential to the work of anyone trying to advance justice. But it's not just proximity. I think the second thing, at least for me, is that I'm persuaded that we really cannot create a healthier country, a healthier community, unless we commit ourselves to changing narratives about what justice requires. There are so many narratives out there that are designed to make us accept the status quo. They're designed to make us accept the class hierarchy that exists in this society, in every society. They're designed to make us accept the mistreatment of those that are dealing with dysfunction and abuse. And I think changing that narrative is key. And we've been doing a lot of work for children prosecuted as adults. We have this problem in America that we have all over the world where we're sometimes fascinated when kids do bad things, when they do violent things. And our fascination actually allows us to do these things that really result in us treating them not as children, but as these special kinds of criminals, these special kinds of offenders. And this narrative has emerged in America that's been quite destructive. We had some criminologists 20 years ago talking about how some children aren't really kids. They said that these children may look like kids, they may sound like kids, but these aren't children. They said that these kids are super predators. And they use that word to characterize a generation of children, mostly black and brown children. And states reacted by lowering the minimum age for trying children as adults. And today in the states, we have 250,000 people serving long prison sentences for crimes they committed when they were children. Some as young as 10, 11, 12 years of age. We have 15 states with no minimum age for trying a child as an adult. And this problem of dealing with children as if somehow they're not really children created a narrative that we've been trying to change. I got involved in these cases many years ago when I had a young client. My clients have gotten younger and younger and younger. But I had a young client who was 14, living in a house where his mother had been the target of a lot of domestic abuse. The man who she was living with would get drunk sometimes and come home and just be abusive and violent. And one day the man had been drinking and he walked into the house and he called the boy's mother into the kitchen. And she went in there and the man just punched her, didn't say a word, just punched her. and knocked her on the floor. She was unconscious, bleeding. And this little boy, her son, ran into the kitchen to try to help his mom get up, and she was covered with blood. And after 20 minutes, he couldn't get her to respond. And he believed that his mom was dead. But the man had gone into a bedroom and fallen asleep until this little boy got up and he walked into the bedroom and he went over to the man's dresser drawer where he knew he kept a handgun. And tragically, this little boy opened the dresser drawer and he pulled out the gun. And he walked over to where the man was sleeping and he stood there pointing the gun at the man's head. The man was snoring and he was snoring and he stopped snoring. And when the man stopped snoring, tragically, this little boy pulled the trigger. And he shot the man in the head. The man died almost instantly. Now, this child was never in trouble before. He wasn't the kind of kid who had been in issues. He had no prior juvenile adjudications or delinquencies. And he was the kind of kid that probably would have been tried as a juvenile, but for the fact that the man that he shot and killed, his mother's boyfriend, was a deputy sheriff. And because he was a deputy sheriff, the prosecutor insisted that this child be tried as an adult. The judge certified him to stand trial as an adult, and they immediately placed him in the adult jail. Today in the States, we have some 10,000 children under the age of 17 in jail cells with adult offenders. Well, I got to the jail, and I went to go see this little boy after he'd been there 3 nights, and he came out. He was a really tiny kid, about 5 feet tall, under 100 pounds. He sat down. I started asking him questions, and no matter what I asked him, he wouldn't say anything in response to what I was asking. He just kept staring at the wall. And finally, I put my pen down and said, look, I can't help you if you don't talk to me. You got to talk to me. The kid just kept staring. So I got up and I walked around the table. I pulled my chair close to him. I said, come on, I can't help you if you don't talk to me. You got to talk to me. Wouldn't say a word. And there was a point during the interview where I didn't know what to do, so I just started leaning on him. I don't even know why, but I started leaning on him. And there was a point where I felt him lean back. And when he leaned back, I put my arm around him and I said, come on, I can't help you if you don't talk to me. You got to talk to me. Tell me what's going on. I did that. This little boy fell into me and started crying hysterically. And through his tears, he began talking to me, not about what happened with the man, not about what happened with his mom, but he began talking to me about what had happened at the jail. He told me on the first night he'd been hurt by several men. He told me on the next night he'd been sexually assaulted by several people. He told me on the night before I'd arrived, there had been so many people who had hurt him, he couldn't remember how many there had been, and I held this little boy while he cried hysterically for almost an hour. I left that jail and I kept asking myself, who is responsible for this? And I realized that we are. All of us in America who have allowed these narratives to emerge that have tried to persuade us that some children aren't really children. All children are children. All of them. And when we forget that, and when we move away from that, we do things that actually not only damage these children, but damage our commitment to protecting children. We got that little boy out of there, and I'm happy to report that some wonderful people got involved in his life, and he's doing much better. But we have so much work to do to change narratives. And what's fascinating is that we are very good in every society at creating narratives that are rooted in fear and anger. Mass incarceration and excessive punishment have flourished in America because we've been corrupted by the politics of fear and anger. And when I look at history, any history, Irish history, any history, you will see this narrative of fear and anger pushing people to do things that are destructive and abusive. If you want to understand how we can abuse certain people, certain religions, certain groups, then understand the narrative of fear and anger behind it. And so for me, changing that narrative becomes essential. We cannot achieve the kind of justice we want for the poor, the marginalized, the immigrant, the disfavored, racial minorities, unless we work on changing these narratives. In America, we have a horrific history of racial inequality. The legacy of racial discrimination is a long-term one. We haven't done very much to confront it. I'm persuaded that we've got to change the narrative. I work in Alabama. It's a state that is in many ways a perfect example of our failure to confront the history of racial inequality. We had slavery in America, but unlike other societies, and it was interesting to spend time on Connell Street and to see some of these icons of Irish history, many of whom played a critical role in speaking against slavery. Hearing about the relationship between Frederick Douglass, who's one of my heroes, and the great leaders of this country who were inspiring and encouraging the abolitionist movement. And yet, there's nothing like that in Alabama. You can't find a statute like you have on O'Connell Street about someone who has a legacy related to abolition, to slavery. And we were different in the States. We weren't a society with slavery, as many countries were. We became a slave society. We actually created a narrative of racial difference to sustain and legitimate the domination of people of color. We created myths about people of African descent. We said that they're not as smart, they're not as capable, they're not as hardworking. And because of these myths, we actually are doing something noble through enslavement. And the tragedy, of course, was that we had a constitutional amendment at the end of the Civil War that ended forced labor, but it didn't really end the myths. And that's why we're arguing that slavery didn't end in America. It just evolved. It turned into something else. It turned into an era of terrorism, where we lynched people, we threatened people, and we intimidated people, and we abused people, and that era is the era that produced my people, my parents, my grandmother lived in the shadow of lynching and terrorism, and it shaped her worldview. And these lynchings were a dominant part of our history, and yet we do not talk about them. Now, even the Civil Rights Movement, which I know was so profound, particularly in the North, it's been really affirming to me to hear from people how much they were inspired by the Civil Rights Movement. And I dare say that there are many of you in this country that have a deeper appreciation of the dynamics of that movement than we have in the States, where we tend to celebrate the civil rights experience, but we don't celebrate it with any awareness of all of the suffering and struggle behind it. But my parents were humiliated on a daily basis every day by racial exclusion and segregation. We had to go to the balcony. We couldn't go to the main beach. We couldn't go to the prettiest parts of the park because those were reserved for white children. And that exclusion did something. It created injuries that we haven't addressed. And yet we haven't talked about them. We didn't commit ourselves to a process of truth and reconciliation. And because of that, we continue to struggle, and that narrative has to change. In America, we have this tendency to be so celebratory. Next year will be the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. And yet, because of criminal disenfranchisement, there's never been a time in American history where you see more people of color who've lost the right to vote. And today in Alabama, 34% of the black male population has permanently lost the right to vote as a result of a criminal conviction. And yet there is this silence. So I think we've got to change the narrative. In South Africa, after apartheid, there was a recognition that we could not move forward without truth and reconciliation. In Rwanda, there's a recognition that we will not recover from the genocide without truth and reconciliation. And yet in the States, we've tried to move on. I go to Germany, and I'm always fascinated to see the legacy of the Holocaust. Germany has decided that it cannot be silent about that legacy. You can't go very many places without seeing the markers, the monuments, the shrines, the museums. You can't. And I think that's a very healthy thing for society to do. Because until we change narratives, we will not become a society that protects itself from its excess. There are parts of Irish history that are problematic. There are times when we weren't responsive to the needs of our poor. There were times when we weren't responsive to people who were suffering, who were living in the margins. And there still are these challenges. And I'm persuaded that the narratives that we create are essential to creating justice for these communities. And for me, the work of FLAC is important because it's in part work designed to create a new narrative about what we can do for all of the citizens in our community. What can we do for the people who have really been crushed by the mortgage crisis? What can we do for the people who can't afford to pay the fines and the debts that they owe and are now facing these horrific outcomes? What can we do for new immigrants? What can we do for the people who have been living in the margins of our society? And it's that narrative that is the essential narrative that I think is important for creating justice. The third thing for me, and I should mention these get harder as I go along, I'm sorry about that. The third thing for me is that I am persuaded that if we're going to be a community of people who actually protects justice, who advances social justice, we have to be hopeful. It's one of the hardest things, and it may seem silly for me to stand up here and talk about being hopeful, but I am persuaded that where there is hopelessness, there's great inequality. There's nothing more that creates the opportunity for injustice and inequality than hopelessness. I'm persuaded that injustice prevails where hopelessness persists, and it's not just collective hope and institutional hope. A lot of times it's individual hope. I go into court sometimes and I'll look around and I'll see the judge who seems hopeless, and I'll see the prosecutor who seems hopeless, I'll see the defense attorney who seems hopeless, and I know that there will not be a good outcome for the accused. Hopelessness is a real threat in any society because it makes you accept the status quo. It makes you accept the inequality, the abuse of power, the distribution of resources in ways that are unfair. It makes you comfortable with these disparities. And I am persuaded that we each individually have to be hopeful in our positioning, in our relationship with the organizations that we care about, in our positioning in talking to the people who call us over the lines, in our positioning with the relationships with the institutions that we're trying to support. Hope, I am persuaded, is essential for creating justice. Vaclav Havel talked about this. Havel said the kind of hope you need to create justice isn't a pie-in-the-sky thing. It's not a preference for optimism over pessimism. Havel said the kind of hope you need to create justice is rather an orientation of the spirit, a willingness to position yourself in a hopeless place and be a witness. And I am persuaded he is right. Now, I wish I could say that being hopeful is something that you just develop over time, that you just get to a certain point in your life where it just happens by itself. But the truth of it is, it's a struggle. It's something you have to work at. It's something that you have to kind of challenge yourself around. You have to test yourself. And I find myself at times are really tempted to get hopeless about a situation. We have 200 people on death row in Alabama. It's amazing because Alabama is actually the same population as Ireland. We have about 4.5 million people in the state. But whereas you have less than 4,000 people in jails and prisons, we have 30,000 people in jails and prisons. We have 200 people on death row. Well, it's the largest death row per capita in the United States. We do not have a right to counsel for people after they've been convicted and sentenced to die. And so we struggle to meet the legal needs of these people, and sometimes the needs are so overwhelming that it can make you feel like there's no way to meet all of these challenges. And then for me personally, what I struggle with the most is this legacy of racial inequality, because not only have we not told the truth and confronted it, we sort of boast in our resistance to ending slavery. If you come to Alabama, you'll find all of these monuments and markers that celebrate the leaders of the Confederacy that tried to retain slavery, that memorialized them. You know, all of the schools are named after these people. Jefferson Davis, the leader of the Confederate Army, the president of the Confederacy, his birthday is a state holiday. It's not Dr. King Day in Alabama. It's Dr. King, Martin Luther King / Robert E. Lee Day. We don't do the things that are, I think, reflective of a society trying to get closer. And when I see these things, they bother me. I don't like the images of the old South. I don't like it when people talk about the good old days of the late 19th century and the early 20th century. It provokes me. I was going to a prison not too long ago, and there was a truck outside the prison. And this truck was like a shrine to the old South. It had all of these Confederate flags and had all of these symbols and images of the old South. There were bumper stickers on there that were actually suggesting that that slavery wasn't a bad thing. One of the bumper stickers read, quote, "If I'd known it was going to be like this, I'd have picked my own cotton," which was this sort of complicated and indirect reference that it would have been better if African people had never been brought to the States. And it was so provocative to me. And I walked into the prison really upset. When I got to the door, there was a guard there. And this white guard said to me, I said to the white guard, I said, "Hi, I'm here for a legal visit." And when the guard saw me, he says, "You're not a lawyer." I said, "Oh, yes, sir, I am." He said, "Well, where is your bar card?" "Well, the card we carry in the States to prove our membership in the state." I said, "Well, my card is in the car, but I've never had to show that before." He said, "You're not coming in here because I don't believe you're a lawyer until you show me your bar card." So I went back to my car to get the bar card, and I came back and I showed it to him. I said, "I want to go see my client." He said, "Well, I'm not letting you in. You're going to have to go in the bathroom. I need to give you a strip search." I said, "No, sir, lawyers don't get strip searched to see their clients. So if you're coming into my prison, you're going to get in that bathroom, and I'm going to subject you to a strip search." Couldn't get anybody to help me, so I had to go into the bathroom. I subjected myself to this humiliating search. And finally, I came out, and I was trying to regain some dignity, and I said, "Look, I want to see my client now." He said, "Well, you've got to go back there and sign the book." I said, "No, sir, lawyers don't sign that book. You're coming into my prison, you go back there and sign the book." So I did. I signed this book and finally went through all of these hoops until this man would let me in. And they opened the door for me to go into the visitation area. But before I went in, the man grabbed me by the arm. He said, "Wait a minute, let me ask you something." He said, "When you came in, did you see that truck out there in the parking lot with all of those bumper stickers and flags?" I said, "Yeah, I saw that truck." He said, "I want you to know that that's my truck." Really provocative. And I went into the visitation area, and I was really quite upset, just angry. And I was sitting there waiting for my client to come in. And my client was somebody I'd never met before. I knew the man was disabled, but I hadn't met him yet. And this African-American man came in, and he sat down. And before I could say anything, the client said to me, quote, "Did you bring me a chocolate milkshake?" And I thought to myself, this is the strangest day I've had in a really long time. I said, "No, I didn't bring you a chocolate milkshake. I'm your lawyer. I'm here to represent you." And I started asking my questions, and 10 minutes into my questions, I realized he wasn't paying attention. And I thought he was still hung up on this milkshake. And I said, "Look, I'm sorry. I didn't know you wanted me to bring you a milkshake. The next time I come, if they let me, I'll bring you a chocolate milkshake." And he smiled and smiled and smiled. A very disabled man. Actually grew up in the foster care system. He was in 29 foster homes by the time he was 10. Horribly abused, horribly neglected. At the age of 11, his foster parents actually took him out to the woods when they couldn't manage him. They tied him to a tree and left him there. He was found 2 days later. By the time he was 13, he was showing signs of schizophrenia. At age 15, he was using crack cocaine to manage depression and bipolar disorder. At the age of 16, he was a heroin addict. At the age of 18, he was homeless and dealing with psychotic episodes and extreme drug addiction. During the midst of one of these psychotic episodes, he committed a brutal crime at the age of 19. He went to trial and unfortunately didn't get a very good lawyer. We still have a system of justice in America that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. Wealth, not culpability, shapes our lives. And this man was charged with a capital crime and sentenced to death in a proceeding where at no point did anyone ever utter the words mental illness, mental health, mental disability. Completely ignorant of that reality. And so we got involved after I met him and tried to present the evidence that might show a court that he had been unfairly convicted and unfairly sentenced. And every time I went to see this client, I'd have to explain to him that they wouldn't let me bring him a milkshake before I could get him to even pay attention. But after a few months, we were ready to go to court, and I had all of my experts ready to testify, and I felt very good about the case. And we went to the courthouse a couple of hours from the prison, and when I got there, I saw this guard who I'd dealt with that day. I hadn't seen the guard since. This guard had been so abusive and difficult. And sure enough, he was the guard that had brought the client to the prison. I went through my ritual with the client. The client seemed fine. And for the next 3 days, we put on evidence about his mental health and his disability, his abuse, his neglect. We contextualized his life. We changed the narrative of his crime. And at the end of the 3 days, I felt pretty good about the hearing. I felt like the judge was listening. We had a chance. And about a month later, I went to the prison to see the client. And when I got there, out in the parking lot was that truck. And it was covered with the bumper stickers and flags still. And I saw it and I thought to myself, "Oh God, I don't even want to go in there today. I'll just come back another day." When I was a little boy, they used to sing that song, "Don't Let Nobody Turn You Around." In the civil rights movement, I realized I couldn't reschedule. I had to kind of just confront this. And so I walked past the truck and went to the prison. And sure enough, there was the guard standing in the front door. And I walked up to him and I said, "Hi, I'm here for a legal visit." Before I could even think what to do next, he said, "Hello, Mr. Stevenson, how are you?" Through me. I said, "Well, I'm fine." I said, "I've got my bar card." He said, "Oh, I don't need to see that." I said, "Okay, well, I'm going to go in the bathroom, get ready for your search." He said, "Oh, Mrs. Stevenson, we don't have to do that." Completely through me. I said, "Well, I'll go over here and I'll sign the book." He said, "Mr. Stevenson, I saw you coming and I signed you in. Would have never predicted it." I said, "Well, thank you for that." He said, "Yes, sir." And he took me over to the door and I watched this guard try to unlock the door as a padlock. And I watched him try to get the key in the padlock and he couldn't do it. His hand was shaking. And he was clearly getting emotional. I couldn't figure out what was going on. And finally he got the key in the lock and he unlocked the padlock and he unlocked the door and he opened the door. But he looked at me and he said, "Mr. Stevenson, can I say something to you?" I said, "Sure." He said, "I just want you to know that I think what you're doing is a good thing." Completely floored me. He said, "I want you to know I was in that courtroom and I was listening. And I came up in the foster care system too." He said, "I didn't think anybody had it as bad as I did, but I realize now that maybe your client had it worse than I did." He said, "I've been a very angry person my whole life, but I think what you're doing is a good thing." And then he said, "Sir, I just want to shake your hand." And I shook his hand and I said, "You know, I can't tell you what this means to me. Thank you, thank you." I said, "It really means a lot to me that you said that." He said, "Yes, sir." And I was about to walk inside to see the client, and the man grabbed me by the arm and said, wait, I got to tell you something else." I said, "What's that?" He said, "Well, I just want you to know that I did something on the way back from the courthouse." I said, "What'd you do?" He said, "Well, on the trip back from the courthouse to the prison, I took an exit, and I took your client to a Wendy's and I bought him a chocolate milkshake. It's a really silly story, but it speaks to me about the importance of us staying hopeful about what we can do. Ireland's the kind of country where there should be complete equality. Ireland's the kind of country where we have the capacity of actually reaching down and helping those most in distress and helping them recover. Ireland's the kind of country where we have the kind of character, the commitment, the vision to make sure that all children are treated as children, that there is no discrimination, there is no bias, that we actually create a society that thrives for everyone. But it requires us to be hopeful about what we can do. Hopefulness is hard. It's really hard. But it's essential. Fourth and finally, I am persuaded that we actually cannot achieve social justice, protect social justice, unless we choose to do uncomfortable things. And I told you they get harder, and there's nothing harder than that. But I'm persuaded that it is essential. The civil rights movement in America was a movement made up of people who chose to do uncomfortable things. There was nothing comfortable about subjecting yourself to the abuse and terror and violence of segregations. Committing yourself to nonviolence, incredibly difficult. I look at the reform movements that have gone on across the world, and they've required people who have been willing to stand when others are sitting, people willing to speak when others are quiet, and that can be painfully uncomfortable. And so it is. FLAC cannot do the work that it's trying to do. We cannot do the work we're trying to do at EJI without people choosing to do uncomfortable things. Now, I'm not against comfort, believe me. I like comfort just like everybody else. I'm all for comfort. I actually gave a talk down in Mississippi last year, and I got off the plane, and the people came to meet me. So, Mr. Stevenson, we know all about you. We know what kind of person you are. We know what you believe. And the conference is being held in the DoubleTree Hotel. It's very, very nice. And we decided you wouldn't want to stay there. We've asked one of the farmers if they would put you up in the barn. And I said, what is wrong with you? I want to be at the DoubleTree. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is choosing to do something uncomfortable. You know, we're programmed to be comfortable. We go to places. We look for the people we know. We sit in the places that we know. We live in the parts of the community that are comfortable. It's okay. But we have to choose to do uncomfortable things if we're going to protect justice. I've often felt like that there ought to be some relief from choosing to do uncomfortable things when you've done a certain amount of things, right? I've had the privilege of spending time with some remarkable people. Mike Farrell, who I had a brunch with yesterday and spent time with today, is a remarkable human being. And there ought to be a space in our society where people like that don't have to choose to do uncomfortable things anymore because of the things they've done. But the truth of it is that we are all called to keep making uncomfortable choices. And sometimes when you least expect it, you have to do it, and it's hard. So we represent people on death row, and sometimes we have difficult days. Alabama, between 2009 and 2011, had the highest execution rate in America. We had 17 executions during a 30-month time period. Every other month, someone was being executed. And because we don't have a system of providing lawyers, me and my young staff were stepping in to try to stop these executions, and it was very challenging, very difficult. And after the first six or seven, I was worried about the young lawyers, so I said, no, I'm going to take the next couple to try to give my folks a break. And I jumped involved and got involved in a case involving a man who was intellectually disabled. And it was a painful case because we actually have a law that bans the execution for people with intellectual disability, people with mental retardation. But because this man couldn't get the lawyer he needed at the time he needed it, the issue was being deemed procedurally barred. We have a commitment to finality that trumps our commitment to fairness. And every court we went to said, too late, too late. And on the night that he was scheduled to be executed, I got this dreadful call telling me that the stay motion had been denied by the Supreme Court. I was on the phone explaining to this man what had happened, and it was painful and difficult and overwhelming. And at the end of the conversation, the man accepted what I told him, that we weren't going to be able to block the execution, and he just wanted to thank me. But in addition to his intellectual disability, he also had the added challenge of having a severe speech impediment. And because we were so close to the execution, he couldn't get his words out. He was trying to thank me, but he was so nervous and so anxious about what was to happen to him, he couldn't get his words out. And the harder he tried to talk, the harder he tried to get his words out, the more it just seemed to break my heart. And I was standing there holding the phone while this man was trying to get his words out, and there were tears running down my face. And finally, I just didn't know what to do, but he was trying so hard, and I actually remembered something I'd forgotten when I was talking to him. I remembered how when I was about 9 or 10, my mother had taken me to church one Sunday. And we were standing in church, me and my friends, and we were talking away. And there was a little boy, a little skinny kid, standing next to one of my friends I hadn't met before. And this child wasn't saying anything, and I looked at this little boy, and I asked him a question. And I never will forget him trying to answer my question, but he also had a very serious speech impediment, and he couldn't get his words out. And when he tried to talk, I hadn't met anybody who had that challenge and difficulty. I did something really ignorant. And when he tried to get his words out and he couldn't, I laughed. And my mother was standing across the room and she saw me laughing at this child. And she gave me this look I'd never seen before. And my mother called me over to her and she said, don't you ever laugh at somebody because they can't get their words out right. Don't you ever do that. And I tried to defend myself. I said, Mom, I'm sorry, I didn't know. And she said, no, Brian, you know better than that. You know better than that. And then she told me, she said, now I want you to go back over there and I want you to apologize to that young boy. And I said, okay. And then she grabbed me by and she said, wait, after you apologize, I want you to hug that little boy. And I looked at her kind of suspiciously. And then she said, after you hug him, I want you to tell him that you love him. I said, Mom, I cannot go over there and tell that little boy that I... And she gave me that look again. So I did. I ran over to this little boy and I said, look, man, I'm sorry. And then I sort of lunged at him and gave him my little boy version of a man hug. And then as insincerely as I possibly could, I said, and I love you. And what I'd forgotten until the night of this execution is that when I stepped up to that little boy, I'd forgotten how he hugged me back. And he said flawlessly, he said, I love you too. And I'd forgotten about it until I heard this man trying to get his words out. And he was trying so hard. And finally he got the words out and he said, I just want to thank you for representing me. Thank you for fighting for me. And then he said, I just want you to know I love you for trying to save my life. And when he hung up the phone, I just thought about how broken he was. And I just couldn't answer these questions. I hung up the phone and I thought to myself, I don't want to do this anymore. It's too hard. I thought about how broken he was. I kept asking myself, why do we want to kill all the broken people? What is it about a society that makes them want to crush the people who have been broken by disability and illness, broken by dysfunction, broken by structures and systems that have served them so poorly? What is it about us that makes us want to crush and hurt and execute the broken? And I started realizing things I hadn't realized before. I realized that my life is filled with brokenness. My clients are broken people. They're people broken by disability. They're broken by poverty. They're broken by racism. They're broken by marginality and exclusion. They're broken by hopelessness and despair. And then I realized I work in a broken system. We've got judges and prosecutors who have become broken by their cynicism and hopelessness. Broken by their failure to imagine a world where we can do better for the poor and the disfavored. Broken, broken, broken. And I just said, don't want to do this no more. Tired of it. Too much brokenness, too much pain. And that's when I had to have that conversation that you sometimes have to have with yourself when you're doing uncomfortable things. And I said, you know, if you're not going to do this anymore, Brian, you should think about why you've been doing it. And I realized something I hadn't realized before. I realized that night that I don't do what I do because somebody has to do it. I realize I don't do what I do because someone has trained me to do it. I don't do what I do because there's a need to do it. I don't do what I do because it's important. I don't do what I do because I have an opportunity to do it. I don't do what I do for the money. There's not a lot of money. I don't do what I do because I have a wonderful opportunity to talk to great people like you. I realized that night that I don't do what I do for any of those real reasons. I realized that night that I do what I do because I'm broken too. And the truth of it is that when you get close to inequality and suffering, when you get close to abuse of power, when you get close to systems and structures that are crushing people and hurting people, it will break you. You'll get little cuts and bruises and scars. But it's in that brokenness that you recognize your humanity. I realize that I am just like the condemned I stand with. I am still poor. I'm still completely committed and connected to those who live in the margins of society. And when they are pushed down, I'm pushed down. And when they suffer, I suffer. Because their brokenness is my brokenness. There is something empowering in recognizing our humanity, which is all rooted in our vulnerability. vulnerability, our brokenness. And I'm persuaded because we are broken, we have no choice but to stand with those who are being pushed and crushed and violated. My clients have taught me really simple things. I believe that each of us is more than the worst thing we've ever done. I believe that for every human being. I believe that if someone tells a lie, they're not just a liar. I believe if somebody takes something that doesn't belong to them, they're not just a thief. I think even if you kill somebody, you're not just a killer. And there is this human dignity that must be respected by law. I'm also persuaded that in America, and in Ireland too, in most parts of the globe, I don't believe that the opposite of poverty is wealth. It is arrogance to suggest that we can actually create balance and equality by throwing money here and throwing money there. We make the mistake sometimes of believing that all we need is just a little resource here, a little resource there. I am persuaded that the opposite of poverty is not wealth. I am persuaded that the opposite of poverty is justice. And when people commit themselves to just relationships, just structures, just treatment, then and only then can we deconstruct the systems and realities that sustain poverty. And finally, I believe that you have to judge the character of society, its commitment to the rule of law, its civility, not by how it treats the rich and the powerful. As much as I love Dublin, as much as I love my time in Ireland, this country has to be judged not by how it treats the powerful, the rich, and the privileged. You judge a society and its commitment to the rule of law, not by how it treats the affluent, but by how it treats the poor, the incarcerated, the disfavored. It's in that context that we find who we are and recognize what we must do to actually make justice live. I wish it were easy, but it's not. It's quite hard, but it's also quite important. And I feel very privileged to do what I do, to be rewarded in the ways that I have been rewarded, to simply stand with condemned and incarcerated people, to be in community and in partnership with wonderful organizations like FLAC, to be in spaces like this filled with people who are proximate, changing narratives, hopeful, and doing uncomfortable things. I'll end with this. There are times when it seems as if the rewards and successes that people would define for us are the wrong things, right? They'll lead us in the wrong direction. I teach in a law school, and I tell my students all the time that I'm persuaded that we won't create justice simply by the smarts that we have, by the strategies that we develop. I'm persuaded that justice is created not by people with just good ideas in their mind. Yes, you've got to be strategic, you need to be informative, you need to be tactical, but you get to justice not with the ideas in your mind. You get to justice when the ideas in your mind are fueled by some conviction in your heart. It's the heart of a person, it's the heart of an organization that matters most to me, because I know it's in that heart that people persuade themselves to do difficult things, believe things that they haven't seen, to do uncomfortable things. I was giving a talk in a church not too long ago, and I was giving this talk, and in the back of the church there was this older man sitting in a wheelchair. It was a small church in a rural county in South Alabama. There weren't a lot of people there. And this man came in a wheelchair and he was staring at me the whole time I was talking. He had this very tough look on his face. And I couldn't tell whether he was angry or what the problem was, but he was sort of distracting. And I got through my talk, and at the end of it, the young people came up and they were very nice and very appropriate, but the man kept sitting in the back staring at me. And when everybody had left, this man got a little boy to wheel him up to me. And he came up to me with this very tough look on his face and looking at me with his frown, and his eyebrows were kind of pulled down. He was staring really harsh, and he came up to me and he said, "Do you know what you're doing?" And I stepped back and he asked me again. He said, "Do you know what you're doing?" And I started mumbling something. I didn't really know how to respond to this. And then he said to me, "I'm going to tell you what you're doing." And I never will forget it. He looked at me, he says, "I'm going to tell you what you're doing." And then he says, "You're beating the drum for justice." And it moved me. He says, "You're beating the drum for justice." He said, "You keep beating the drum for justice." And it moved me so much. And then he said, "Come here, come here, come here." And he grabbed me by my jacket and he pulled me into the wheelchair. And he says, "I'm going to show you something." And he turned his head and he said, "You see this scar I got behind my right ear?" He said, "I got that scar in Greene County, Alabama in 1963, trying to register people to vote." He said, "You see this cut I have down here at the bottom of my neck?" He said, "I got that cut in Philadelphia, Mississippi during Freedom Summer in the 1960s. And then he turned his head, he said, "You see this bruise I have?" He said, "I got that bruise during the Children's Crusade in Birmingham, Alabama." He said, "People look at me and they think I'm some old man sitting in a wheelchair covered with cuts and bruises and scars." And then he said to me, he said, but these aren't my cuts, these aren't my bruises. He said, these aren't my scars. He said, I may be an old man, I may be in a wheelchair, I may be covered with cuts and bruises and scars, but I'll tell you something. He said, these aren't my cuts, bruises, and scars. He said, these are my medals of honor. And there's nothing that I can say that makes me understand the importance of what happens when people commit themselves to doing difficult things, uncomfortable things, changing things, than what that man said to me. Even here, we need to beat the drum for justice. Even here, we've got to find ways to create proximity and change narratives, do hopeful things and do uncomfortable things. Even here, we need organizations like FLAC to do critically important work to protect the least among us. I'm excited that there are so many of you who join in this effort, who stand with those who need you to stand with them, who support those who need you to support them. And I'm deeply, deeply honored that you've invited me to have this time with you. Thank you so very, very much.
Yes, that was Brian Stevenson there, US public interest lawyer, and he was speaking at the FLAC's 8th annual Dave Ellis Memorial Lecture. And thank you to FLAC for the invitation. And myself and Pat Meehan went along and had a listen, and it was excellent stuff. Thank you for that.